Good morning. It's 8:15. We're going to go to our first interview for the local news hour this morning. It's a pre-recorded interview. And Ski Utah President and CEO Nathan Rafferty spoke with Leslie Thatcher earlier this week about the opening of this year's ski and snowboard season. Ski Utah's annual State of the Ski season opening was held yesterday. Joining us now was some of the highlights, Ski Utah President and CEO Nathan Rafferty. Good morning.
Morning.
So we're only how many weeks or days away from opening day?
Who knows? Some of the resorts put specific dates that they open, and then others are ready to go at a moment's notice. So when the temperatures drop, when Mother Nature decides to swoop in and leave some snow here, I think you'll find resorts popping open anytime.
Yeah. So based on kind of the published dates that people are putting out, it looks like Bryanhead may be the first in Utah?
Potentially. I've seen some photos and videos up at Brighton. They made snow in that cold snap. Everybody did. And, they could get going really quickly. So, either of those two wouldn't surprise me in the very near future.
All right. Well, speaking of Bryanhead, though, news, of course, this week that a new owner, I'm surprised to see, that's been like a longtime family-owned resort for
It was. And then John Grissinger, the current owner, who is just such a great guy, he bought it less than a decade ago. I want to say five, six years ago. And it's actually a great story. He bought it sight unseen. He's a non-skiing guy from Kansas City who was in the, his family was in the chemical business or something. And he bought it sight unseen from the bank, drove up to Bryanhead in a crazy snowstorm. And he has really turned that place around. I mean, their visits have significantly increased. He pumped a bunch of money into it. He's this kind of larger than life, nicest guy you'll ever meet, has, really created an incredible culture down there. And I guess the time was right. And he's sold it to James Coleman, who currently owns Nordic Valley and a bunch of other smaller ski areas in the Southwest. And he has a similar track record of being a great community partner and really pumping some life into these small ski areas that frankly can really struggle if they don't have the right ownership.
Yeah. And then Woodward Park City, of course, they're just off of Interstate 80, scheduled to open this winter. Ski Utah is considering it Utah's 15th resort?
Absolutely. They got a chairlift. You can drive up, buy a lift ticket, ski. I think you'll spend half your time in the air if you go over there and do it like you're supposed to. But, they're really our headline this year in terms of what's new. So it's not every year that we add another resort to, our family or resorts here in Utah. And those guys have been great. And what's neat about Woodward is they're adding something totally different to our ski scene. So, I think most people are familiar with what's happening over there, but it is, it's a product unlike anything we've seen here in Utah with all the action sports stuff, more things than, I can mention here.
Yeah, well, and that's interesting to me, though, that just all it takes to be a resort is a chairlift.
Well, we're kind of shooting from the hip on that one because we don't have a product like this, but we felt really strongly that they should be included. And, there's just enough angle over there that maybe I can burn a few powder laps on the way to work and dodge some of the big jumps. But I'm really excited to see how that adds to our overall mix here in the Utah ski industry.
Yeah. You also spoke about the economic impact of the ski and snowboard industry. Of course, last year we saw a record year in terms of skier days. I'm not sure that it was record-breaking in terms of snowfall, but of course, as we all remember, it was pretty awesome. So talk a little bit about that economic impact.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. So we broke an all-time record in terms of skier visits, 5.1 million skier visits last year. That was our first time over the 5 million mark, and a full million skier visits more than the previous season with such a challenging snow year. And I think you're right. It wasn't it didn't break any records for snowfall, but man, it felt like it should have because there was just so much snow last year. It was so incredible. I feel like the winter just barely ended, honestly, with skiing going all the way to July 4th at Snowbird. So 711 inches of snow, but our industry is a big deal in this state. You know, spending on skiing and snowboarding in this state now comes to close to $1.7 billion, and that's in a $9 billion statewide overall tourism spend. So you know, we're big business in this state.
Yeah. So what kind of impact does last year's record year and great snow then have on the upcoming season? Do we see anything happening as a result?
Absolutely. So there's always a tailwind from one year to the next. And if there, you know, there were few lowlights from last year, but if there was, if, you know, I had to nitpick it, is that we didn't get off to the start that we could have because of that low snow the previous year. That's not the case this year. So everybody remembers what an unbelievable year we had last year. And it wasn't just in Utah, it was all over the West. So skiers are, you know, generally have very short memories. They only remember back to their last powder day. And for a lot of people, that was just a few short months ago. So, you know, it's great for season pass sales. It's great for advanced bookings. And, you know, we kind of set them up and Mother Nature knocks them down. So we are in as good a shape as we can be. We had that early cold snap and some snow to get people excited. And as soon as it starts snowing here in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be ready to rock and roll.
Yeah. You had also mentioned, of course, the airport expansion, the new SLC, I think we're calling it. That doesn't get finished, though, for this year, right?
It doesn't, but it's so exciting, and it's such a big deal for our industry and our state, you know, not just skiing, but our current airport, which is great. It's extremely convenient. It was built in the 60s to handle 10 or 11 million passengers a year, and the last year alone, our airport did 23 million passengers. So we sorely needed this upgrade. It'll keep all the convenience of our old airport, but add a real modern and wow factor. When you know, it's the first and last thing people see when they come to our state to visit it, whether it's for business, visit family, come skiing or snowboarding. And I think it's going to create this wow factor that we've lacked at that airport.
What's the expectation, though, in terms of impacting skier days?
You know, I think it adds to our message of easy in, easy out. You know, the rental cars are going to be right on site. You're not going to have to get in a bus and take it, you know, 10 miles down the road to get in and out. And you can land at the airport and be here in Park City in 30 minutes. I mean, that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world.
Yeah. So we can get now more people in and out of the airport easily, but let's talk a little bit about transportation, getting them up the two-lane road in the Cottonwood Canyons or sitting in traffic trying to get in and out of the Park City resorts. I understand that we're all about growing the ski industry, but at some point, I mean, is enough enough?
You know, it's a great question. We've worked for decades to get to this point where we're seeing the kind of visitation that we want to see, and we need to work just as hard on the local level to make sure the experience that we have for our guests and our locals getting in and out of town is as good as the ski experience. And certainly there are some frustrations on those busy powder Saturdays that are also weekends and holidays. But it's something we work on just as hard as we do to market people to get here.
Yeah. And you did have some news just in terms of some of the the new Ride On Park City app here in Park City. We're going to see some significant increases in bus service as well up the canyons.
Yeah, it sounds like so. I know the town of Park City here has a great new app that'll, I think, really streamline things and help things along for the many thousands of employees that come in and out of our town. The Cottonwood Canyons have a ride app that they've been working on for a while that will also help get both visiting skiers and snowboarders and their employees up and down the canyon. Huge kudos to UTA, who has increased ridership for this coming season between 26% and 28% in those two canyons over there. So these are all things that we're working on, baby steps. And then UDOT is in the middle of their environmental assessment that will come out next year and hopefully put us on a path towards some pretty significant upgrades to some of those canyons to kind of move that traffic a little bit better. But, you know, our real focus is on getting having less single occupancy vehicles into and out of town, and it's something we can all be better at, whether it's Park City or Cottonwoods or any of our resorts in the state.
Yeah, and this year more money than ever to market, $25 million from the state legislature.
Yeah, yep. So the state, you know, really sees this value of tourism. This is something that is so great for the state economy, and I won't say it's insulated, but it has less of the ups and downs that some of the other industries in the state have. So even when we saw the economic downturn, tourism and travel in general stayed fairly strong throughout. So, you know, we're happy that they're looking at it as a very long-term and sustainable economic benefit for the state.
And certainly speaking of sustainability, we saw a lot of sustainability news from the resorts. Can you focus on a couple of those improvements?
Yeah, you know, our resorts have done a fantastic job in terms of sustainability. I think about half of them have full-time sustainability directors there. About half of them have public electric vehicle charging stations, Snowbirds, sustainability manager Hillary Ahrens. She received the National Skiers Association Hero Sustainability Award just last year. 10 of our resorts have gone plastic and straw free. Alta does a super job. They planted 1,500 trees in last year alone. And, you know, at Ski Utah, we don't have a big carbon footprint, but we continue to push public transit and ride sharing through our app. And our, you know, our probably our most visited website page is our snow report. And we do that. And then we also spend a ton of time leveraging our influence with elected officials to make sure they're doing their very best to, you know, keep their eye on sustainability efforts.
Okay. Making any predictions for the coming season?
You know, best ever. That's what I say every year. But, you know, get your powder skis out. I'm crossing my fingers for if we had half the snow we had last year, I'd be excited. I had so many good ski days, and it's a really exciting time of year just getting ready to have some fun out on our mountains. And I just, man, we are so lucky to have these incredible ski areas in our backyard, so can't wait to get out there.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
I think that's it.
Okay, Nathan, thanks.
Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour, and we have Executive Director of the Park City Community Foundation, Katie Wright, in here in the studio, and Meg Steele with Vail Resorts here as well to give us an update on some amazing early day numbers. So we probably don't even need to talk about Live PC, Give PC, because obviously everybody knows about it.
But it wouldn't be fun not to talk about it all day long, because that is the energy around town. This is Katie from Park City Community Foundation. I just dropped off my daughter at McPolin, and there was just a gaggle of kids raising money for their school, and so fun to see. And that's what this day is all about, is everyone, young and old, doing what they can to support nonprofits and make this amazing community even better. So it's just such a fun day.
So, Katie, you gave me earlier in the hour, well, in the last hour, you gave me some phenomenal numbers of where things are right now. And I know that the focus this year is participation more than a revenue target. But can you kind of review those?
Sure. So we are just shy of $650,000, which is absolutely amazing. That's more than we raised in total the second year of Live PC, Give PC. And we also have 1,693 donors. And Meg was actually sharing some stats about what that looks like in comparison to past years.
Yeah, we're looking at, compared to last year, we're up 13% in dollars right now and 12% in donors. One of the really exciting things that I think is driving some of these donor numbers is we have a new donor challenge. So if people are first-time donors to Live PC, Give PC, there's a challenge sponsored by Vail Resorts Epic Promise. And when you donate to a nonprofit as a new donor, that is going to be matched $10 for every donation you're doing. So if you donate to five nonprofits, that's another $50 that's going straight to those nonprofits and straight to those total numbers for Live PC, Give PC.
So let me clarify. So of the 600 and something thousand that you just covered, Katie, does that mean for every dollar or for every donation
for
that
new donors?
New donors.
To Live PC,
okay,
Give
okay.
PC.
And you said how many new donors so far? thousand?
That we have to do after the fact because that's quite some formulaic math. But we know that donors in general are up 12%. And that's, you know, a couple years ago, we decided to focus less on the money because the goal has always been about participation. The money is fantastic as well. LivePC, GivePC has raised over $10 million since it started 9 years ago. And last year we raised $2.4 million. So we hope to exceed that, of course. But most importantly is everyone doing what they can. And the collective impact of that, I think, always blows us away.
Sure, sure.
And for existing donors as well, there's opportunities to increase your donation. So many nonprofits have matching grants that will double your donation. So check online and see if your nonprofits have matching grants. There's still almost $300,000 left in matching grants. And watch for Power Hours through today as well. And then you can increase the impact of your donation.
Okay, great.
And then another thing to remember is we have leaderboards, and they are sponsored by excellent organizations like Blue Sky and Talisker Club, University of Utah Health Plans, and Dominion Energy. And what happens with those is that it's like a vote when you decide to give to a nonprofit. And then we rank them by number of donors that have given, and then the top nonprofits win additional grant prizes. So whether or not you can give $5 or $500 or $5,000, when you make a donation to a nonprofit, you're voting for them and helping them win additional grant prizes.
Yeah, and so this really offers a chance for people to connect in this event and connect as part of a community.
Yes. One of the wonderful, among the many wonderful stories I've heard over the years was about someone who had just moved to the community, logged on to give, thought about, well, I use the trails, so I'll give there. And then just explored on the website and learned about Children's Justice Center. 6 months after making his donation, he had joined the board. And as we know, that amazing nonprofit has built or has now secured a facility to help children who have been abused recover. And it's so critical for those kids and those families. And this all that person's participation just began as a LivePC, GivePC donation and then became like a really dedicated volunteer position. And so there's so many examples of nonprofits who have connected with someone who shares their passion, and that relationship becomes year after year and really deep, and it's service. And so the ripple effect is amazing.
Yeah, life-changing, really. Mm-hmm. Not just for the children who might benefit from those engagements and that resource, the funds, but just life-changing for the people who get involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, and with 117 nonprofits participating, I think there's something that everybody will want to look at giving. I don't even know if it's possible to live in Park City without interacting and connecting with nonprofits in some way, whether you're dropping off your glass recycling or your kid has an after-school program or you're out on our trails in open space. So this is our opportunity to give back to those organizations.
Yes. Yeah, so how many, what's the goal for participation?
We're hoping for 5,000 donors. And there's giving days across the country, and there's no doubt that our participation is off the charts. So way to go, Park City. But we want to get it even higher.
Okay. And what has our participation been in the past? Any sense of that?
Last year, we were 4,790 donors. So looking at increasing that this year. And I think we're going to be able to surpass that 5,000 even.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else that you would like to say about the day?
Well, as we've sat here, more money has been raised. We're now at $661,000 and over 1,700 donors. So I encourage everyone, please visit livepcgivepc.org and give generously to the nonprofits that you love and maybe some that you're just learning about.
Yeah. And I can just reiterate how easy it is. I mean, the whole thing is so simple. You just go on to livepcgivepc.org, select donate, and there you have it. You've got all of the nonprofits you can scroll through, or maybe you know exactly where you want to go and you can type it in as a search, and there it is. So very simple, doesn't take any time.
Yep, simple, and your dollars are likely to be matched. So give and give generously.
Okay, well, thank you. That's Katie Wright, Executive Director of the Park City Community Foundation, and Meg Steele with Vail Resorts. Appreciate you coming by.
Thank you.
It's 8:41. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour, and the Park City Council met Thursday to discuss transportation in Old Town, historic preservation under the Flagstaff Development Agreement, and more. Here with a recap is Lynn Ware Peak. Good morning, Lynn. Thanks for coming. So let's talk about there were quite a few items during the work session about the Old Town access and circulation plan, something that has somewhat been initiated by concerns from residents on Hillside Avenue. There wasn't really a lot of time to talk about this, even though there seemed to be a lot of people who wanted to give public comment, and they did during the regular meeting, but there are a lot of stakeholders involved in this. The HPCA, residents, lodging, transportation. How are we going to come to a solution on this?
Well, first of all, Carolyn, let me just tell you, this last night's City Council meeting was the longest and the most complex of any council meeting that I have been to. It also involved the biggest number of people from the community, which was so great. So many people who are very well informed and really are our stakeholders and our community members that are really helping us arrive at a lot of these decisions we're making. So when it comes to Old Town circulation, you know, we're looking at a sort of a broader and more holistic approach to Old Town circulation. And you can look at it kind of piecemeal, but that will only get us so far and it will only be so effective. But that said, if you look at the approach, it can be twofold, right? We can do, and one of the things proposed was to do this big, broad, expensive study and assessment of really what needs to go on in every component and every aspect, whether we're talking Hillside and protecting our residents in Old Town to how we're going to establish some kind of order on Main Street. That would be figure that out. Or the second approach would be to pay attention to what we think is broken and to listen to our residents and their anecdotal studies and our merchants and our taxi drivers and Uber and Lyft and all of these components that make up everything that goes on in Old Town. So I think what council really wanted to do is take the second approach, which is maybe a more phased, a more tiered approach. We had a bit of sticker shock over the amount of money that was to be spent on this big assessment, which was somewhere in the order of between $200,000 and $300,000. And as we know, you know, you do a study and then it seems like 2 or 3 years later, that study is almost invalidated because things are changing so rapidly in our transportation world. So what we're trying is some low-hanging fruit, some simple and less costly solutions. And one of those is the drop and load zones. And we think that there's hopefully great promise with that. But even as some residents pointed out, you know, for example, we're planning on these drop and load zones being on the east side or say the post office side of Main Street. And as one Hillside resident pointed out, well, where are those, how are they going to get are the cars going to get to that east side? Are they going to come down from Marsac and Silver Lake and come down Hillside to get to those spots? Would it be better to have the spots on the west side so they'd have to go down to the roundabout and come up Main Street? You know, so all these kinds of considerations is what our economic development and transportation planning staff is really focusing in on. And so, oh, in short, it's going to be a series of maybe trial and effort based on some really good data that we already have and some really expert opinion, and then also all of our stakeholders. And we really thank them for being part of this process and also for being patient.
Yeah, so just to kind of step back for a second about the whole project of assessing the traffic flow, we've got basically gridlock at times on Main Street during the high, you know, traffic times, during the high visitor times. We've got neighborhoods associated or contingent to, you know, to Main Street. So they're struggling with the kind of traffic coming through. You've got vibrancy that you want to maintain. You want people to come to Main Street. You want them to shop there. You want them to spend their money and, you know, help with that part of it. What else? What is the other factor besides those things that you have to consider? Because this is a really hard decision to figure out what the answer is.
Right. Did you mention residents?
And the
traffic.
Neighborhoods.
Okay, yeah. The neighborhoods, yeah. And traffic seeping out into those. And, you know, a lot of it also has to do with how you can harness something like Google Maps to not send their navigation through the neighborhoods. You know, that's another thing. But I think you really encapsulated what it is. We want vibrancy on Main Street. We want people to come and go and spend money and have a great experience on Main Street. We don't want gridlock on Main Street. We don't want our resident population who chooses to live in Old Town because it's, wow, what a great place it is to live, to be so impacted and affected. So it is a huge, complex balancing act. And, you know, it's very easy to say, well, just do this. And if you just do that, then the trickle-down effect can be devastating and, or not devastating, that's a little dramatic, but can be really impactful for another segment of your population. But I think the big thing for me is, you know, we can't have double parking. So this is taxi drivers, this is Uber and Lyft, this is hotel shuttles. We can't have double parking, and so we have got to train our visitors and our residents that if you're coming in one of these modes of transportation to Old Town, you're going to have we're going to establish some drop zones that require that you might have to walk 50 steps to your restaurant or to the place that you're visiting. And so it's sort of a retraining effort, I think, for all of us. The other portion that I think is really important is that we do education of, you know, hotel shuttle drivers, for example. And the Lodging Association has been really great working with us on this, where they have now said they've committed to, you know, just some good faith efforts of not circling through Main Street and constantly circling around Hillside Avenue, for example, and coming down and not coming as an empty van all the time. This is something that was pointed out last night, that, you know, one hotel schedules their shuttles down to Main Street for every half hour, while another one just, you know, circulates empty vans all the time. So there will be this high level of service for their guests who are paying thousands of dollars a night. So it's about education and making everyone our partner and saying, listen, we are in this together. And we've got to solve this all together, and everyone's got to be on board.
Yeah, so there were some comments made in public input suggesting one way, making Main Street one way. I mean, that doesn't solve traffic going through neighborhoods,
right.
But it does offer a little bit of leeway.
Yeah, yeah. And then you say, well, if we did one way, then what's the other one way? You know, does that become Hillside? Or does it stay on Sweet Alley? Could we harness traffic to stay on Sweet Alley to come up one way and go down Main Street the other?
Yeah.
Remains to be seen.
And the drop-offs, that's another complex. I mean, will it end up being like the airport, where if you're not actively dropping or picking up, you move along?
Well, enforcement is the big thing here. And, you know, it's going to be a big hurdle, but that is the key to everything, is enforcement. We've got to have people out there. If we have drop and load zones, we have to make sure they're enforced so people are using the zone and not double parking. Because what if we eliminate all this parking on Main Street to put these drop and load zones in, and then they're not used and they sit empty because people are double parking? Like, that will not work
right at
all.
And there's some discussion, at first it was maybe 4 or 5 drop zones. Now it's maybe a little bit closer to 10 or 8 or something
right,
like that.
Right, right. And there's some free parking zones, you know, just like these spots down here on Sweet Alley under the radio station outside Bob Wells. And then we're talking about some in Bob Wells. It was a work session. It'll come back to council, so I don't think we have really solidified. We want to work again with all the players and figure that out.
So do you anticipate, as a council, having some of that low-hanging fruit addressed before this season comes?
Yes, yes. I think the idea is it comes back to council late November, and then, you know, we approve it for implementation mid-December.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you're still taking input, it sounds like. I mean, a lot of people showed up last night. And
Yeah.
So
we really appreciate it.
They can contact council members if they've got a thought on that. And we cannot even, we don't have time to get to the other topics about the historic preservation requirements, but maybe you want to quickly say
something. Let me just
say
really quickly, again, thank you so much to our historic preservation enthusiasts, and there are many in this town, and they have helped us so much establish really the crucial and the needed, like as in right now, stabilization of some of the historic mining structures. And we just need to establish a funding source and how we're going to allocate it and how we're going to get the responsible parties to ante up what they have needed to do over the last 20 years that it hasn't been done. So we'll get there.
And the money's there.
Well, the money is there, and it is allocated in some different ways. It goes for historic preservation as well as open space. And so we've just got to figure that out. And then in the meantime, you know, we've allocated some money to shore up the Judge Mining Office roof is about, well, it's collapsing as we speak. Mm-hmm. So this is the thing. It's, you know, the time is now, and certain things we just can't wait on any longer. And going forward, there are some other things that we can do long term.
Right. Public safety. I mean, that has to sort of be at the top.
Yeah. And making it, you know, once a building collapses, you can't redo it, you know, and Sandra Morrison already pointed out some of these structures that have gone by the wayside very tragically, really, because it's our history. It's who we are as a town, and it's important.
Exactly. Well, thank you, Lynn Ware Peak, council member, giving us an update. Boy, I imagine we'll have a chance to talk with you before you depart council. I'm hoping because the elections came through. Becca Gerber, Nan Worrell, and Max Doyle taking your seat, and so we'll.
And they'll do great. And also, thanks to everyone who ran and who really stepped up to put their name out there. So good effort, everyone. Just really quickly, Wednesday, November 20th. The Park City Future Summit. It's part of the visioning that we're doing over many months in Park City, 6 to 8 p.m. Jim Santee Auditorium, and really important for all of your friends and neighbors and everyone to show up and have a community conversation.
Okay. Thanks a lot. That's Lynn Ware Peak, Park City Council member. You're listening to KPCW Local News Hour. Well, good morning. Our last guest is our own KPCW station manager, Ann Tilley, of course, in the studio here. She's going to try to, basically bark out the construction sounds going on outside. We've got Live PC, Give PC today, and Renee Bodley is here to tell us about it.
Good morning, Carolyn. Thank you, first of all, to you and to our listeners for putting up with that construction noise this morning. It's really loud this morning, isn't it?
First time, I think.
Yeah, they've been so good about keeping it quiet. But frankly, as anyone doing construction these days knows, we're trying to beat the winter. So our goal is to clear out all this construction equipment by December 20th before the holidays. And so we're going to be going full throttle until then. And so, listeners, thank you for your patience through all of this noise. It's truly not an intended sound effect. It really is what's going on. Anyone who drives down Sweet Alley can see it. Speaking of driving down 224 this morning was a lot of fun. There are so many groups at all the various intersections waving their banners and their signs. They're in their bright orange T-shirts. I was with the KPCW gang since 7:30 this morning down at the Olympic Parkway and 224, getting that Kimball Junction traffic as they're coming in and going out of town. And the Park City Community Foundation has a group of folks who are driving around and giving donuts and coffee to all of the groups, which is much appreciated. Thank you, guys. And then it's really fun because all the people who are driving by are honking and waving. And it's just this really great vibe out there in the community.
Yeah, and it's been, we've talked to Katie Wright now twice from the Park City Community Foundation. It's been an amazing morning. It seems like everybody knows it's going on.
Yep.
Even if you maybe haven't been out yet in your car. But it's been over $600,000 raised so far.
I heard her give those numbers. That's wonderful. And she's going to be, someone from the Community Foundation will be checking in with the radio station all day long. So keep it tuned here to keep track of how the progress is going. And I just wanted to take a couple minutes, Carolyn, and give a pitch for KPCW on this day of giving. You know, we are a nonprofit public radio station. There is no subscription fee. We are putting so much of our information now on our website, kpcw.org. And Carolyn, I was just looking at our Google Analytics stats for our website yesterday, and we had 67,000 users on our website for the month of October. And I've been telling everybody that ever since we started putting our stories online in 2018, that we went from 8,000 users a month to 32,000 users. Well, I had checked that number probably back in April or May. And this summer, we have trended up to 40,000, 50,000, 60,000, topping in October with our 67,000 users. So we're really reaching out to the community. And what's great about what we're doing, I believe, is that anyone who feels like they are part of the Park City community, no matter where they are in the world, can stay in touch by listening to our radio station online, on the mobile app, or reading our news stories on our website. And all of our public affairs shows, which are wonderful, are also available as podcast. So many people listen to this show, the Local News Hour. And I think we can both agree Leslie Thatcher is probably the hardest working woman in local news. And thank goodness she could take a day off today. She's missing the noise. That's a podcast as well. So people who might miss an interview between 8 or 9 in the morning can download the podcast and listen to it later in the day.
Yeah. We've got it covered, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And thanks to you guys, the news reporters, this is an extra labor of love for you guys. I mean, we couldn't create more hours in the day, and you are keeping up with the reporting schedule, not only getting the stories on the air, but also by putting them online. So a big hats off to Carolyn and David and Emily and Rick Bruff. And again, this is all available for free. So if you could please, those of you listening, please find it within your wallet and your heart to log on to livepcgoodpc.org and find KPCW and give us, you know, minimum $5 donation is what they're looking for. And last year we won our leaderboard, which was really exciting because that gave us the benefit of, I think, $1,750. Which was great. And the year before, we actually tied Mountain Town Music. And that was exciting because Park City Community Foundation actually doubled the first prize for us. And like Park City Community Foundation, KPCW is a nonprofit that helps all other nonprofits. Just this week alone, on Monday, Park City Education Foundation was on the air talking about the Grandparents Evening, which I believe was last night. We had Recycle Utah on with Randy. We had Summit Land Conservancy. Cheryl Fox was in here talking to Leslie. Of course, we had election night Tuesday night where David and Emily worked over the night and they turned out the election results so people could hear them as they came in. Gosh, who else have we had on for the nonprofit? Park City Film was in talking about their production. It was the Local Filmmakers series, I believe Katie was talking about.
Yes, and then Youth Sports Alliance was in.
Youth Sports Alliance.
Talk about their amazing Get Out and Play programs. And
we do trail reports, you know, in the wintertime. So if education is your thing, we give Park City Education Foundation and the school board free airtime to tell you what's going on. If open space is your thing, we give Utah Open Lands and Summit Land Conservancy and Mountain Trails Foundation time to come on the air. If you're into youth sports, and we're going to be covering the Park City High School football game. That will be on the air tomorrow at 5. We're going to carry that live. We really are a community connection, and studies show that when you have a strong source of local news in your community, that community is less divisive. It has better infrastructure. It has better schools. It has a more engaged citizenry. It really is this intangible, impactful, positive benefit to a community.
Right. And just a reiteration of the whole Community Foundation's goal this year, it is to get engagement. Their goals are not a dollar figure, it's engagement. We want more people to donate, and we really are hoping that more people will donate to KPCW this time around.
Show some love to your favorite nonprofit, and you know, we'd like to say we're like the oxygen mask on the plane. Give KPCW some money so we can help other nonprofits as well.
Thank you. That's Renee Bodley, station manager for KPCW. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up is